Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WJUP FM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming from the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida. My guest is Professor Michael Curtis. Our subject is the Middle East, ISIS, and the future. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Professor Curtis, to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Richard, and welcome back.
Thank you very much. Professor Michael Curtis is the Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's highly regarded as an expert in several fields, political theory, comparative government, European politics, and the Middle East. He's the author of Should Israel Exist? And Orientalism and Islam, European Thinkers on Oriental Despotism in the Middle East and India. Professor Curtis has previously been a guest on The Advocates on January 25th, 2012, and earlier on April 27, 2011. In the past year, November 2014, after our last interview, Professor Curtis had the unique honor of being appointed a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor by the French president. That's very, I gather that's pretty unique for an American. And among his approximately 30 books, a few should be singled out as particularly important and influential. His verdict on Vichy was published in 2004, examined the degree to which French legal and administrative system, the church, individuals in different walks of life collaborated with the Nazis who occupied France. In his book, Three Against the Third Republic, he examined the rise of anti-democratic and anti-Semitic ideology in France after the Dreyfus Affair, and is considered the definitive study of this era in the early 20th century French political history. He's considered an expert on the Middle East. He was one of the first to discuss the tangled web of interconnections between religion and politics in the Muslim world, in religion and politics in the Middle East. He's given lectures at hundreds of institutes and institutions. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey, and I always give a plug to Princeton because that's where my son graduated. He's married, has two sons, and a number of grandchildren. You know, Professor Curtis, the modern Middle East as we know it has existed since the breakup of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. The gradual carving out of the nation states in that region, the end of the British Mandate in 1947, the recognition of the Jewish state of Israel, and the establishment of the Arab West Bank under the trusteeship of Jordan, all came about in that, I would say, tumultuous period after the First World War. To start us off, Professor Curtis, how and why did these states, Iraq, Syria, and the Emirates of the Gulf, come into existence?
Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you for your wise words, generous words, and so on. We're dealing, of course, with a very interesting and complex subject. As you've just said, these states are relatively new. They're all 20th-century states that came into existence after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire, of course, had been in existence since the 15th century, but in the 19th century, it began losing all of its European territories, and had a very loose relationship over some of the others. It made the catastrophic mistake of allying with Germany in World War I, and therefore was defeated. Now, what had happened was that, meanwhile, while the war was going on, in 1916, the two diplomats, French and British, Sykes and Picot, had come together and made the secret agreement to partition the Middle East after the war, because the Ottoman Empire was presumed to be defeated. And therefore, it set up artificial boundaries that there would be British and French control over the area. Britain would be given what could be called the coastal strip between the Mediterranean and Jordan, part of South Iraq, and various other spots. France would be given southeast Turkey, northern Iraq, what would become Syria and Lebanon. So these protectorates were set up. In other words, France got Syria. And by the way, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was between the two countries, but it also had the assent of Russia, which was still in the war. It was Russia, after the revolution, that disclosed the secret agreement had been taken place. So to answer your question briefly, Britain set up Iraq and the Palestine area and a mandate which was to be established. France got Syria and Lebanon. Palestine, by the way, or the area which was become Palestine, was not given to any one party. It was called an independent administration, but by the League of Nations mandate that was set up, Britain got control over it, and the British control lasted until 1948. When the State of Israel was established. The Emirates were, in a sense, now a group of seven Emirates. Formerly there were sheikdoms and so on, and they came together in 1971, with ruled by sheikhs,
And I think they were called. I think they were called the Trucial States at one
the
time.
The Trucial States, yes, originally. They call them the Emirates of the Gulf. They're called by different names, but that's what they are now. So that these states were established in Palestine. Of course, the area was under control. But in 1922, Winston Churchill, while he was colonial secretary, hived off the area which was then called Transjordan. That is the area across the Jordan, which then became the Emirate and then the state of Jordan. So that's where we are with these artificial states. The old states remained. Persia became Iran. Egypt remained. Saudi Arabia was established after tribal warfare. But I think the important thing is that they're all artificial states. The boundaries are drawn by the great powers, and not surprisingly, the area is contentious, partly because of that, those artificial borders that were established.
Right. You know, since that period, and you've described it quite well, of course, the emergence of Transjordan, the remaining area that was the mandate, which today is Israel and the West Bank. Since that period after World War I and until World War II, there seems to be three distinct dynamics guiding that region. The relative instability of Arab regimes, whether it's over conflict of religion and secularism, the interest in exploration of oil by European interests, and the conflict between Arabs and Jews in the British mandate, for better or for worse. Professor Curtis, what was the importance of each dynamic? Has anything really changed?
Oh, yes, I think a great deal has changed. Well, one thing, I mean, you call them a relative instability, but it's total instability of it. The states that we've been talking about, these artificial states, Syria, Iraq, and Libya, which, of course, became independent from Italian control, are failed states. They no longer function on the basis of regimes that have any kind of control over the whole population. And the life in Libya, Iraq, and Syria is chaotic right now. Now, there are a number of factors, and each of them, you know, one can spend a lot of time on. Oil has been important since Standard Oil discovered oil in Saudi Arabia in the 1930s. And, of course, you have the important meeting in 1945 between President Roosevelt and King Saud on a boat in Egypt. And that's the point at which the oil issue was linked to the United States national security, a kind of a bargain that the Saudis would supply cheap oil, and of course they still do, in return for the United States protection of that country. But since then, all the area has been involved in revolutions and wars and upsets and so on. And one of the major problems, which is still pertinent in relationship to current events, is the safeguarding of the Persian Gulf. Things have changed a great deal since the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. So there's an interrelationship of oil and war. Even though the United States, of course, is now oil independent to a considerable degree. But above all, of course, what has been happening in the last few years has been the rise of Islam as a political force. And more than Islam, the Islamist insurgent, which has produced the chaos in the world today with the terrorism of which we're all very concerned.
Well, you know, it's interesting, of course, and a last dynamic, of course, maybe we'll get back to a little later, the conflict between Arabs and Jews and the mandate. My sense of it is it's an excuse, almost like the difference in Northern Ireland between the Catholics and the Protestants. My sense is that the West Bank, if they sought peace, would probably diffuse a lot of the argument that is used all over the world about that being the catalyst for this anti-Western feeling. But we're going to get into that probably a little later. Another issue that is, I think, critical, Professor Curtis, is global warming. You know, it's been talked about as a pretty important factor in the Middle East. On the Arabian Peninsula, the summer heat has reached record levels, and there was a reading this summer of 56 degrees centigrade, or almost 133 Fahrenheit, which is incredible. Is global warming in the Gulf and the Middle East becoming a critical factor affecting politics, migration, and tension?
Yes. I saw that report, and it's kind of, in a sense, horrifying, the recent studies that, in fact, show that the area may be unfit for people to survive with the continuation of greenhouse gas emissions. I think the projection was that in Kuwait, the temperature might go on up to 140 degrees. Now, I'm an agnostic on global warming in general and so on, but the answer to your question is no, that the human life can't be available in that set of circumstances with the increase in warming. So I presume what would happen is that people would begin, as soon as it becomes terribly obnoxious, to emigrate.
Right, and then part of it, from what I understand, is people moving.
But then, of course, one doesn't know what the impact of the warming would be elsewhere.
No question. And from what I understand is that people are not living in the countryside in these areas where there's desert, barrenness, and they're moving into the cities, which is making them almost unlivable in a situation. There are a lot of dynamics there. You know, we have a couple of minutes before the break.
I mean, yeah. You asked a question, does this affect politics today? I don't think it has any impact on politics today because there are many other issues of greater priority. But maybe by the end of the century, it may be significant. At the moment, there's not something I think that one should be terribly concerned about.
So that's not on the radar screen yet, but it's out there. Aside from the earlier points I mentioned, how does the struggle between Sunni and Shiite fit into the equation of Middle East instability? You know, it's even said today that many Arabs are not even religious today. I mean, is this sort of like the, as I said, I alluded to Northern Ireland? I don't think it was a Catholic-Protestant situation. I think it was a tribal situation. Who has the power? Is that what really is the dynamic Sunni versus Shiite, or is that a fig leaf for other problems?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a fig leaf, but certainly there are other problems there. I mean, here we're dealing with an issue that perhaps we don't fully understand, and maybe the Muslims don't fully understand it either. There is this division, as you know, in the Islamic world between Sunnis and Shiites, and a dislike and even a kind of hatred between them. What is it all about? Well, you can say it's still a dispute about who was the rightful successor to the Prophet Muhammad, who, as you know, died in 632. And the two sides claim priority in this respect. The Sunnis won the fight between them, and Sunnis constitute, it is said, about 80% of the Muslim world, which is now about 1.5 billion or 1.7 billion people in the world. But there are other different views of Islam into which we don't have to go. It becomes a rather esoteric issue. But it's also a question of theological, religious, but political things, not simply over the rightful successor to the Prophet, but political and economic issues. What has happened today is that the Shiite minority, led by Iran, has now become enormously belligerent and therefore a challenge to the rest. And so we've got an ongoing situation, but it's not entirely clear, because we also have ISIS, which perhaps we can talk about, which is Sunni, not Shiite. And therefore, you have these two manifestations of extremist Islamic activity, which threatens the West, and which is a threat to Western civilization from both the Sunnis and the Shiites. But the picture is far from very clear. One has to be kind of careful in assessing this. I mean, take the country of Yemen, which is in the throes of chaotic and also a failed state. Now, you have Saudi Arabia and the Sunnis on one hand against the pro-Iranians on the other. So it's a mixture, a mixture of religion and politics that is taking place.
So it seems
I can say that from a political point of view, I think that concerns us.
Yeah. Well,
the Shiites dominate Iran and Iraq, Bahrain, Azerbaijan. And these areas were relatively quiet until 1979, when the Ayatollah Khomeini took power, overthrew the Shah in 1979. And that's the point at which this Islamic Shiite extremism began.
I got to go to a break, but it's interesting which, and I think you've articulated well, is which is the dynamic that pushes the other. Is religious, religious dynamic push the political? Does the political push the religious? I have to go to a commercial break. My guest is Professor Michael Curtis, the author, noted historian, a professor, and we're discussing the future of the Middle East, some of a bit about the past. We're going to get into talking about ISIS and its threats. You are listening to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM. We have to go to a word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a second or so. Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Michael Curtis. You are listening to The Advocates on WJUP-FM. We've been talking about the Middle East, some of its history, the dynamism between Shiite and Sunni, the interlocking connections and rivalries between different states in its recent past and its present, and we'll address today some of the events and the future. You know, the Middle East has been a tinderbox of conflict for, in the modern sense, for 100 years. The heart of this century-old conflict has been Jerusalem, the birthplace of three monotheistic Western religions, with Abraham as the patriarchic founder of not only Judaism, but influential, obviously, for Islam and thus, and first Christianity and thus Islam. But today's big story is not Jerusalem, but the emergence of ISIS and a new call for a pan-Arab Muslim caliphate. Professor Curtis, what brought on ISIS? How does it fit into the struggle between Sunni and Shiite, the threat of Al-Qaeda, and the age-old conflict between religion and secularity?
Well, again, it's a mixed and complex picture. ISIS particularly, and I prefer to call it ISIS, but others call it ISIL or in Arabic, Daesh. By the way, yesterday the AP published a story about the top news stories, and ISIS was the top news story of the world today. Climate change, by the way, which we talked about earlier, was number eight in the picture. ISIS emerged out of a terror group that was present in the Middle East. Now, there's a link between ISIS and Al-Qaeda because the group that we now know as ISIS emerged out of a split that took place in the end of the 20th century, so I think specifically about 1999, the group of ISIS pledged to Osama bin Laden, but it became more important after the 2003 Iraq War, and then this group, which was rather small in itself, united with other groups and established what is called ISIS, or the Islamic State. In June of last year, June of 2014, it established the state with a caliphate. So in other words, the caliph goes back to the heritage of the Prophet and afterwards. And the point is, and the significance of it, is that not only is it a ruthless, brutal regime, but it also claims authority over all Muslims. So it is a state now, and that's important, that it has territory, unlike the other terrorist groups. And it has surrogates now in many countries in the world, in North Africa and South Asia and so on. And it has driven out Iraqi forces, and of course, fighting other groups almost to a standstill in Iraq and in Syria. So what it's doing is eliminating all religious rivals in the area, persecuting, of course, Christians especially, Jews, of course, obviously being persecuted. But I think what is important are two things about it. First, that it is a state. And it seems to be a very competent government organization dealing with politics, with administration, with police, social activity, and one which has enormous, very very gifted propagandists who attract younger people from so many other countries. So it's an extremist ideology that appeals to the young, that explains the fact that it's attracted so many jihadists, including, it said, about 500 from the United States. But it's also dangerous because it's expansive. I mean, I mentioned Yemen a few minutes ago. It's intruding in Yemen and trying to take over the country. So it's only a brutal regime in itself. It's also a menace to Western civilization because of its activity and its kind of barbaric attitudes towards Western heritage and Middle Eastern heritage.
Is its attractiveness religion to these foreign warriors, these foreign mercenaries that they bring in? Is it the religion or is it the sense of anti-state and the anti-establishment of what's been there? Is that part of it?
It's very hard to know what the answer can be. Clearly, it's anti-Western and above all, anti-American and anti- Israel, which is seen as a carrier of Western civilization in the Middle East area. But it also has this fanaticism, which is attractive to many. I mean, I cannot understand why three young 16-year-old Muslim girls in a good school in London should go off and join the fight for ISIS. It's incomprehensible that rational and gifted kids and people and him, it can be attractive. You know, I mean, there are something like 30,000 people in all who have been attracted to ISIS. It has a very good propaganda regime. Anyone who looks at their booklet, I've never seen any videos put out by them, but I have seen some of their booklets, and they're very attractive in their call for support and putting on. Remember, it has a good social service department, and we know now that it does engage in frivolity from time to time. But the overall appeal is really very difficult to explain. It's also the case that they kill Muslims as well as non-Muslims because, you know, ISIS doesn't see the people who are not as extreme as themselves as true Muslims, as not believers in the truth, place, and so on.
You know, it's like a reverse.
And I think, let me say just one word about this, because to me it's kind of very serious, where the some Muslims have put up the word Islamophobia as if it's something that is inherent in the Western position of it. Now, this is a word that's been coined by Islamists and so on, which really means you know, the argument that there's increasing or exaggerated fear of Islam, but it's really a concept to silence critics. And one should not be taken in by this, but one should criticize and of course, take action against those extremists rather than be silenced by the threats of being called an Islamophobe.
Right. You know, on the other side of the ideological and geographic equation, there are many who call for a Palestinian state, like the Swedish foreign minister. They blame Israel for not only the terrorism in Europe, but the rise of ISIS. Professor Curtis, is there any validity to this claim, or are the Europeans being politically pressured by their growing Islamic populations?
Yes, I think it's a nonsensical argument. And I dealt with this the other day in an article on Sweden, where I pointed out what I think is the stupidity of the current foreign minister in making that assertion after the terrorist attacks in Paris. How on earth she could relate the two is beyond me, but so on. Now, it's clear that there is a problem, and the problem is the growing Muslim population in the European countries. No one knows the exact numbers because they're not published, but it's presumed there are 20 million who are now in the European Union. And of course, Muslims have been present in Europe in a sense since the 8th century, first of all in Spain and then spread out throughout Europe. In France, the unknown number is supposed to be something between 5 and 6 million now, constituting about 8% of the population. In Germany, about the same, mostly Turks or some. And I think the problem is, and relates to the Swedish foreign minister and others, first of all, there's a growing proportion of the population in the European countries which is Muslim. Secondly, I think they are younger. The birth rate among Muslims is higher, but they're also younger, at least 5 to 10 years younger than the norm of non-Muslims in the countries. And, of course, one can expect vastly more migrants to come in as the chaos in Syria and Iraq continues. Now, obviously, this is going to have an impact on European politics, and I think there are not many people today like the Swedish foreign minister who would assert so unwisely that Israel is involved in these terrible, responsible, the terrible terrorist activity. The truth is that most of the Arab countries don't give a damn about the Palestinians or concern for a Palestinian state. It's the kind of leftist European politicians who do.
Well,
the answer, the simple answer to your question is no, there's no truth whatsoever.
Right. You know, it's like, we're going to go to a break in a half a minute, it's like blaming Israel for the Hucks in Philippines, for the religious strife in Burma between the Hindus and the Muslims, Chechnya. I mean, how does this relate? It doesn't relate in the least. But it's interesting because it's used as a crutch, and maybe we'll get into how that can be, you know, diffused in the future. We have to go to a commercial break, a little bit of a news break here.
I was going to mention the whole United Nations General Assembly, of course,
yeah,
is pernicious in this regard, but that's a whole news story.
I want to get to a news break here. My guest is Professor Michael Curtis, author, noted historian, professor. We're discussing the future of the Middle East. Now we've been talking about ISIS. We're going to get into more of that. You're listening to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM. We'll be back in a second or so. Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Michael Curtis. You're listening to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM. Been talking about the subject, the future of the Middle East and ISIS. It's certainly complex. It's gone through many iterations. There's so much politics, religion, fratricide, tribalism. There's so many things involved in this. Bringing us up to date, more or less, a few weeks ago, President Obama made a rare speech to the nation over terror events in Paris and San Bernardino. In his message, he reiterated his vision of how to contain ISIS and seemed to reject building a massive coalition of troops, which would, of course, be mainly U.S. personnel to confront their threat. Professor Curtis, is this the right strategy?
No. First of all, I mean, one can't take as valid everything he has said. I mean, he has said, for example, that ISIS is not Islamic, which seems to me an absurd statement when clearly it's in the vanguard of Islamist activity and responsible for so much of the terror in the world. Nor do I believe that the United States is necessarily the leader in this fight against ISIS or Islamic terrorism. What seems to me to significant in recent weeks has been the emergence of Russia as an important player. I mean, Putin obviously wants to be an important player in the whole Middle Eastern situation. And he has taken a stand that ISIS must be eliminated. Now, it's true that to some extent his interference may be in support of Assad, the Assad regime, and he has delivered the missiles against the opponents of Assad, but nevertheless, his fight is going on. And what I see is an important coalition between Russia and France, and France has taken the lead in anti-Islamist activity, particularly in Mali, and now much more so in Paris. And it's they that may be successful in organizing a coalition together with those Sunni countries that are afraid of both Iran and all the ISIS, particularly Saudi Arabia, which ought to be playing, and I think to some extent is starting to play a role in this coalition. Now, the United States, I mean, should be involved, of course, involved in it, but I think the other countries are at the moment being more important, being more decisive in their raids against ISIS strongholds and so on. That does not mean, I think, that American troops should necessarily go and fight. Of course, the real fight should be by the Arab states against the threat of terrorism, against the threat of ISIS, and against what would be important there would be, say, a coalition between Saudi Arabia, the Emirate countries, Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, and the Emirates generally. To take the lead in this fight, to have their troops on the ground to try and destroy it. I don't conceive that ISIS can be defeated by air raids alone, significant though they may be at some point.
Well, I heard today that I think Ramadi will be retaken from ISIS, but I want to follow up on this American participation. You know, Americans seem to be divided regarding this issue. You know, 3 months ago, 85% didn't want boots on the ground. Post San Bernardino and Paris, 56% wanted boots on the ground. I hate the term, but it's the best one people understand. Many want to buy time by destroying them by, as you just mentioned, by airborne ordnance by France, Britain, the United States, Saudi Arabia, people flying sorties, and leaving the ideological battle for later. If ISIS continues to grow and the Europeans have no taste for assigning troops, we know that. Should we go it alone eventually? Are we going to have to go it alone? Troops? Could that be a possibility?
No, I think it would be unwise for the United States to go it alone. This would make future attacks on the United States more likely by terrorists. There has to be a universal agreement on this by all right-minded individuals and states, and sooner or later the Europeans will begin to play. Britain is now sending jets in, France is going. Germany has promised, I think, 1,200 troops on the ground. So there has to be individual. No, I don't think that the United States should go in alone, and it really can't do, because it then will be involved in so many other issues.
Right. You know,
the countries I mentioned, Russia, France, and the Arab states, Saudi Arabia. Remember, the Saudis are not only in a theological aspect. Say, I take Saudi as the emblem of Sunni supremacy, because the main Islamic holy places are in Saudi Arabia against Shiite Iran, but they're also regional political and economic rivals.
Professor,
to the interest of Saudi Arabia to do more than it has been doing, even though it still has its own religious extremism within its own ranks.
You know, Professor Gerst, I want to get quickly back to this because I think it's an integral part of this conversation. The issue of the future of the Middle East sends political geographical integrity. In other words, the makeup of Lebanon, especially Syria and Iraq, seem to be questioned. Here's the critical point. We only have a minute or so. Are these countries really states? And with the rise of the Kurds, the continuing fight between Sunnis and Shiites, will there be new borders drawn even in the post-ISIS period? There will be a post-ISIS period. Maybe it won't be tomorrow. Will there be new borders drawn?
Yes, I think there will be the answer to your question, because as we started out by saying, all these states have artificial boundaries, and the boundaries must be withdrawn on some. Now, let's take one of the things. In the Sykes-Picot Agreement and then with the League of Nations, there was one country that was promised a national state, and that's the Kurds. And it seems to me almost impossible if in the future a new country called Kurdistan would not be created out of part of Turkey, part of Iraq, part of Syria. So there has to be, it may well be that some kind of confederation will come into existence when the chaos ends and ISIS is defeated. But some reforming of boundaries has to take place. It's impossible to see it remaining as it is in the future. Remember that it's something we didn't go into, and again, it'd be a rather complex situation. There are minorities within all of these countries.
No question.
And there's the artificial division that took place as a result of the 1922 arrangement.
You know, in the last minute before our next break, I asked you in January of 2012, you had written a book, Should Israel Exist? Previous decades, Israel was threatened by huge Arab armies, the confrontation states of Syria, Iraq, and Egypt. These armies have gone. They've dissolved. We've got a little bit more than a minute left. With that in mind, is Israel facing less of an existential threat in 2016 than any time since its 1948 War of Independence?
The answer is no. I mean, the title of my book, and one of the books, was not my idea. It was the publisher's idea. And the answer, of course, Israel should exist. Israel does not face what you call an existential threat now, because the countries, the Arab countries, are not in a position to challenge it. Egypt is at peace with it. Syria and Iraq are hopeless failed states. The only groups that threaten Israel are the terrorists, Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Well,
they are not an existential threat.
Right.
They're difficult and they must be controlled, and an international agreement must be reached on how to stop it. I mean, stop Iran, for example, supplying weaponry to these two, Hezbollah and Hamas. But it's not what I would call an existential threat.
Okay,
it's different now from what it was a generation ago.
I want to go to our last commercial break, Professor Curtis. My guest today is Professor Michael Curtis, the author, noted historian. We have been discussing somewhat, certainly, how the world is going to deal with ISIS. We just referred to whether the current Middle East is an existential threat to Israel. Of course, you're listening to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM. We have to go to a commercial break. A short word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a minute or so for our concluding segment. Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Michael Curtis on WJUP 103.9 FM. We've been talking about the subject, the future of the Middle East, what shape it'll be, will borders be redrawn, will there be a Kurdistan, what'll happen with ISIS now and after ISIS. You know, back in 2012, you wrote an article, The Sad Plight of Christians in the Middle East. You were right on top of it, obviously. You stated the outlook for Christians is indeed bleak. The Arab countries have not abided by the UN Declaration of Human Rights of December 1948, which states everyone has a right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. Discrimination against non-Muslims has been always present in the Arab Muslim world, and we see it today in the extreme by the extremists. Has the war in Syria and the rise of ISIS made it worse for the vast amount of estimated 12 Christians in the whole Arab world since 2012, not only in the so-called caliphate?
Well, Richard, thank you for keeping up with my past writings. I didn't realize you knew you were an expert. You know more about them than I do.
I don't think so.
Sure, the plight of Christians has got much worse, and it's increasing. I mean, look, just take ISIS. You know, ISIS marks Christian homes in the territory that it occupies with an Arabic letter, N, for Nazarene. And they are discriminated against, persecuted, and of course murdered. And I mean, the sad fact is that in all the Middle Eastern countries, in Iraq and Lebanon and Syria, even to a lesser extent perhaps in Egypt, the number of Christians is diminishing very rapidly. And one might well see Christians have a lower birth rate than Muslims. They're emigrated, they're persecuted, there's violence against them. And there may well be, you know, it was the former Archbishop of Canterbury who said in the next decade, Christianity will be finally wiped out by both immigration and persecution. And just take one fact, for example, in Iraq, there used to be 1.5 million Christians there. Now they're less than 100,000. I mean, all Jews have gone. Now the Christians are going also. Maybe the only exception, the Copts in Egypt, but even they are in a precarious position. I think one of the curious paradoxes is that the only country in the Middle East where Christians are safe and are growing in number and in proportion is Israel.
Yeah.
The only country where they're protected.
Well, and, it's also...
One of the interesting new departures is that a friend of mine, Lord Weinfeld, in London, has started what he calls a safe haven project for rescuing Syrian Christians. And it's extraordinary that a Jew and a Zionist, George Weinfeld, should be undertaking this mission. He started it a month or two ago, and already a number of them have been brought out of the chaos in Syria to safety. So I think that the persecution is continuing. And what is very troubling to me is that the mainstream churches, both in Europe and especially in the United States, say almost nothing about it. They're very willing to engage in the criticism of Israel, especially during the last Gaza war, but say almost nothing about the persecution of Christians in Christ's own homeland.
Yeah, very interesting. We've got a little time for one more probably long question here. You know, a few years ago in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring, and you were on a broadcast with me on this, you described a lot of it. We were discussing it in depth. A number of events have happened since the fall of Mubarak, the destabilization of Yemen and Somalia, the removal and execution of Muammar Gaddafi. Have all these areas become fertile ground for ISIS? Has ISIS replaced al-Qaeda as the major threat in that region?
Yes, I think to some extent it is. And insofar as ISIS claims to establish the stability, to take over areas, and to offer the kind of adjustments that we're talking about, and which one can't fully explain, both the psychological and religious, it may well be that they will come in to fill in the vacuum. Vacuums can't last very long. And if there's no stable, rational political force to take over, ISIS will step in. I think that's why it's capable not only of expanding, although, you know, in Iraq and Syria it's fighting to control the country, but it's become acceptable in so many other areas of the world that have been attracted. You mentioned Yemen, and that's a very good example where ISIS is going in to support the rebel forces that are taking place in that very complicated situation, which we don't have time to go.
Yeah, Yemen is an incredibly complex situation with a lot of forces in. Somalia is a failed state. Even Abyssinia, we wonder about the old Abyssinia, now Ethiopia, has gone through. I mean, there's the Horn of Africa, global warming, poverty, religious fratricide. There's all sorts of dynamics that continue. The West may have to bite the bullet one day and make up its mind what it wants. And I'm not so sure the West, especially reflective of European culture and ever since the end of the Second World War, after 500 years of civil war in Europe, their taste for action, especially regarding their failed efforts on holding their colonial states, whether it was Congo, whether it was Southeast Asia, whether it was Algeria, whether it was Central Africa, they seem to lost their taste for it.
One does begin to despair to some extent about the European Union and its failure to deal with these issues and to be forthright in it. I think the only example is France, and I say that not only because I've been honored by France, but the Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, and even the President, François Hollande, have been not only saying very clearly what the threat is, but also preparing to take action in it.
I got to say goodbye. I want to thank you for joining me today. By the way, where can I get your books? A few seconds do you have? Is there a place where you find your books, on eBay or Amazon?
I suppose they're there. Okay. I don't know where they are, but maybe in news libraries or something.
All right. So one last question.
Help me out.
Quick answer on this. Yeah. Will Assad regime survive 2016?
The answer is I don't know, and for me it's not a serious question. There are divisions between Russia and the United States on this issue, But the survival of Assad or his place in the future Syria, if any, seems to me vastly less
overrated.
Important than the struggle against ISIS,
okay,
which Russia is so concerned.
I got to say goodbye. Thank you again,
okay.
Professor
goodbye,
Curtis.
Richard. Thank
have
you.
Have a great holiday.
Very good questions, and keep reading my articles.
I will. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other Archived Advocate broadcasts, they'll be able to be accessed on my website soon, where information on all my guests will be posted. Next week, my guest will be Dr. Chris Briseth, former president of Wills College, the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, and now the chairman of the board of the Francis Perkins Institute. Our subject will be Francis Perkins, the crisis in American labor, and the threat to the legacy of the New Deal, which Francis Perkins supported tremendously. Thank you very much. Have a great holiday.